Easter is early this year. And unlike Christmas, the date of Easter changes each year depending on the moon cycles, following the Jewish tradition of celebrating Passover after the first full moon, after the vernal or spring equinox. This means that Easter can be any time between March 22nd and April 25th, with obviously the weight of those possible days falling in April. So we are always kind of surprised when Easter comes in March. In fact, the next time the Easter will be on that earliest date on March 22nd is 2285. So, personally, I am always a little relieved when Easter doesn't fall on April 1st. If Ash Wednesday is on, just a little tip, Ash Wednesday is on Valentine's Day, that means that Easter will be on April 1st. But because it's leap year this day, we got March 31st. But being that it is the 31st of the month reminds me that Easter is probably a lot closer than we think to another holiday that is celebrated on the 31st, the day after my birthday, Halloween. Just think about it. A dead body rising from the grave in the middle of the night. When you think about it, Easter is kind of spooky. No wonder the women left Jesus' grave terrified beyond words. Perhaps their fear and silence can open us up into a fresh vision of what Easter is all about. Would you pray with me? God, speak to us beyond our fear, beyond our anxiety, beyond all that we are holding. And may we hear in that silence, the goodness of you that calls us deeper into this world and deeper into love. And may the words of my mouth and the meditation of all of our hearts be pleasing in your sight, you who are our rock and our redeemer. Amen. When my family moved from Walnut Creek to Bend, Oregon, 13 years ago, we had to wait for a few days to move into our new home. A wonderful couple from the church where I would be the pastor, they were empty nesters, and they invited us and our 70-pound golden retriever, Daisy, to stay with them. Our new friend's daughter had a rabbit in her upstairs bedroom that she adored. And even though Daisy was the best dog, she was also very curious, and so we were trying our best to keep the bedroom door closed. But someone forgot to pull it all the way closed. And Daisy made her way into the room and stuck her head into the cage. And that big, curious, golden head inside the cage caused the rabbit to scream and have a heart attack, from which it did not recover. Quite the auspicious start to our new friendship. So I relate to this story that preachers sometimes tell on Easter morning about a woman who found a dog in her backyard, shaking its head violently with the neighbor's rabbit dead in its mouth. Her family had been quarreling with their neighbors, and so she knew this was going to make matters worse. So she got the dog to drop the rabbit, covered with dog spit and extremely dead. What was she going to do? She brought the rabbit into the house. She put its lifeless body into the bathtub. She rinsed his body until it was clean. She found her hairdryer and she blew the rabbit dry. Using an old comb, she groomed the rabbit until he looked pretty good. And then when the neighbor wasn't looking, she hopped over the fence, sneaked across the backyard, and propped him up in his cage. No way was she going to take blame for this death. About an hour later, she heard screams coming from the neighbor's yard. She ran outside, pretending she didn't know what was going on, and her neighbor came running to the fence. All the blood had drained from her face. Our rabbit, she blubbered. He died 2 weeks ago. We buried him, and now he's back. Resurrection is frightening. And this telling of the resurrection story that was in Mark 16 is different than all the other gospels. And if you look it up in the Bible in front of you, you'll see that there are more verses after verse 8, but they are in brackets, and there is a footnote at verse 8 in my Bible which says, "The earliest manuscripts and some other ancient witnesses do not have verses 9 to 20. So the word, in other words, the Gospel of Mark ends with the word afraid. So they went out and fled from the tomb, for terror and amazement had seized them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. Of course they were afraid. I think most of us would be if you were told your dead friend and teacher had risen from the dead. You think you want it to be true, but if it actually happened, what then? What does this mean? The women walk away from the grave in silence, telling no one, at least for a while. One of my favorite poems is titled "Keeping Quiet" by Pablo Neruda. And I wonder if you might help me with it today. There will be two times that I count to 12, and I invite you to join me in counting. So now we will count to 12, and we will all keep still. Ready? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. For once on the face of the earth, let's not speak in any language. Let's stop for 1 second and not move our arms so much. It would be an exotic moment without rush, without engines. We would all be together in a sudden strangeness. Fishermen in the cold sea would not harm whales, and the man gathering salt would look at his hurting hands. Those who prepare green wars and wars with gas and wars with fire, victory with no survivors, would put on clean clothes and walk about with their brothers in the shade doing nothing. What I want should not be confused with total inactivity. Life is what it is about. I want no truck with death. If we were not so single-minded about keeping our lives moving and for once could do nothing, perhaps a huge silence might interrupt this darkness, this sadness of never understanding ourselves and of threatening ourselves with death. Perhaps the earth can teach us, as when everything seems dead and later proves to be alive. Now I'll count up to 12, and you keep quiet, and I will go. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Perhaps the earth can teach us, as when everything seems dead and later proves to be alive. Maybe this is the kind of silence that the women entered into, a silence that interrupted their sadness, a silence that helps them understand themselves, a silence that stopped death from being a threat, a silence that showed them, just like the dead seed that falls into the ground, what is dead can come alive again. The joy of Easter is born from a fearful silence through which God speaks of eternal goodness and love, a love that is stronger than death. Can we get quiet enough to hear it? I love the way that C.S. Lewis reframes the fear of these women at the grave in the story of Susan and Lucy at the stone table. their great and fearless leader, the lion Aslan, has died a torturous death at the hands of the wicked queen. After crying all night, Lucy and Susan begin to care for Aslan's body. They remove the muzzle from his mouth and they wipe away the blood and foam. They try to untie the knots that are tight around his body. And then C.S. Lewis turns to his reader and says, "I hope no one who reads this book has been quite as miserable as Susan and Lucy were that night. But if you have been, if you've been up all night and cried till you have no more tears left in you, you will know that there comes in the end a sort of quietness. You feel as if nothing is ever going to happen again. At any rate, that was how it felt to these two. Hours and hours seemed to go by in this dead calm, and they hardly noticed that they were getting colder and colder." And then Lucy notices the sun rising. And she notices little tiny gray things crawling all over Aslan's body. The mice had come to chew through the ropes. When the ropes were clear, the birds began to sing as the girls were walking around, trying to keep warm in the frosty morning. They heard a large, enormous crack. The stone table where Aslan had been broken, had died, had broken in two. And Aslan was gone. "Oh, oh, oh," cried the two girls, rushing back to the table. "Oh, it's too bad," sobbed Lucy. "They might have left the body alone." "Who's done it?" cried Susan. "What does it mean? Is it more magic?" "Yes," said a great voice behind their backs. "It is more magic." They looked around, and there, shining in the sunrise, larger than they had seen him before, shaking his mane, for it had apparently grown again, stood Aslan himself. And then Aslan began to play with them. They laughed and played and ran, full of joy. The joy on the other side of fearful silence. The prophet Isaiah saw this joy coming. Riding in the middle of an invading empire and facing a forced exile for his people, the prophet writes of a feast of rich food and delicious wine and the end of death and tears. The prophet declares the goodness of God as the ultimate reality. Easter invites us into this kind of hope, not the sweet by and by, but the nasty now and now, as my preaching professor, J. Alfred Smith, loved to say. Theologian N.T. Wright put it this way: here then is the message of Easter, or at least the beginning of that message. The resurrection of Jesus doesn't mean it's all right, we're going to heaven now. No, the life of heaven has been born on this earth. It doesn't mean so there is life after death. Well, there is, but Easter says much, much more than that. It speaks of a life that is neither ghostly nor unreal, but solid and definite and practical. The Easter stories come at the end of the four Gospels, but they are not about an end. They are about a beginning, the beginning of God's new world, the beginning of the kingdom. God is now in charge on earth as in heaven. Here we are in the nasty now and now, invited to live in this vision of God's triumphant goodness, to find it in the internal places where fearful silence threatens our joy, to work for it in the places where there is not enough food or justice and endless tears. When we live as if it's true, we find the truth of it and begin to be able to see God's goodness and also to wait for it with joyful hope. One other favorite poem of mine comes from the Guatemalan poet Julia Esquivel. She was a theologian and a writer who advocated for the human rights of the indigenous people of Guatemala, the Mayan people. She was exiled for her advocacy, and she wrote this beautiful poem called Threatened with Resurrection while she was there. And as she recounts the senseless murders of the Mayan people, she writes, "What keeps us from sleeping is that they have threatened us with resurrection. Because every evening, the weary of killings and endless inventory since 1954, yet we go on loving life and do not accept their death. They have threatened us with resurrection. Because in this marathon of hope, there are always others to relieve us, who carry the strength to reach the finish line, which lies beyond death. Join us in this vigil, and you will know what it is to dream. Then you will know how marvelous it is to live threatened with resurrection, to dream awake, to watch asleep, to live while dying, and to know ourselves already resurrected. To live in the hope of resurrection is to know ourselves already resurrected. Yes, we grieve and suffer. Yes, injustice continues. Yes, the climate is changing with frightful speed. Yes, we don't know what's next in Palestine, but the goodness of God remains. It lives within us. It gives us strength to resist evil. God's goodness is the end of the story. In the last 6 weeks during the season of Lent, our church has been exploring the prodigal son, this story that Jesus told, which offers an image of God as a loving father who goes to any lengths to love his children and to let them know they are loved. And so today I've invited our worship team to sing a song that has been a meaningful companion to me on dark days of fearful silence. It imagines God's goodness running toward us and invites us to live in the goodness of God. Amen.